Warning, this episode contains details that some listeners may find disturbing. January 6th, 1986. At remote hot springs in the Mojave Desert, Barry and Louise Berman were on a couples trip and left camp for a morning walk. Their 1982 Datsun truck was later found abandoned. The Bermans were missing. Something about their disappearance didn't sit right, and foul play was suspected, but the investigation was stalled from the start because no bodies had been found. That is, until 3 years later, when a skull was discovered deep in the desert. Authorities soon found more remains, and they were confirmed to be the bodies of the Bermans. They had been buried in a shallow grave, and their clothes had been methodically hidden nearby. Today, we discuss the still unsolved case and a plausible suspect with the man who knows more about the case than anyone, author and journalist Doug Carey.
The bodies had been stripped of clothing and stacked and then carefully concealed with rocks and dirt. It was obvious that it was a homicide and that they had been deliberately buried.
This is a study of strange. Welcome to the show. As usual, I'm your host, Michael May. Not so usual, though. Today's episode is a special one. Normally, I share strange and unsolved tales to a guest, but today I'm speaking with author Doug Carey about his debut crime novel, The Berman Murders, Unraveling the Mojave Desert's Most Mysterious Unsolved Crime. Thank you for joining me, Doug.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
And I'm going to read just a tad bit from your bio, because I want my listeners to kind of understand your expertise here. So Carey exposes the story of Barry Berman, heir to the Kahlua fortune, and his wife, Louise, who went missing in 1986 in Saline Valley, a popular Mojave Desert draw for nudists and eccentrics. Doug brings a blend of scholarly research and good old-fashioned storytelling to his writing. He believes an immersive investigation. His true crime stories have run on the front pages of LA Weekly, Las Vegas Review Journal, San Francisco Daily Journal, and other respected outlets. You have also practiced law, and you do pro bono wilderness protection work for Desert Survivors, an outdoor group that you co-founded. And I'll ask you about that a little bit later on. But so this is your debut novel, but you're so fascinated and interested in these stories. I'm surprised it kind of took you this long to write one.
Well, it's my debut true crime book, and I'm very happy. It took me many years to put this project together. It became like an obsession. And of course, there were a lot of ups and downs along the way. But yeah, don't hold it against me. I'm a lawyer by background, and that's where I learned a lot of the research skills and the doggedness that it takes to pursue, whether it's a case or a story. And then about 10 years ago, I started pursuing more journalism, writing about true crime, and I got pulled into this story. And yeah, now we've got the book, The Berman Murders.
That's right. And you spent how many years working on this story?
Well, off and on, 9 years. Mm-hmm. It really took a long time to develop the evidence and to get interviews that I chased for a long time. Do the site visits, an incredibly remote area, difficult to get to. I went out there a number of times, and there were just a lot of components. Also, I was writing stories about the case along the way, including a cover story in LA Weekly, and that story itself helped generate some new evidence in the form of tips from prison informants. So there were a lot of moving pieces to the story.
And for listeners, this is a double homicide, unsolved to a certain extent. And do you want to tell people a short synopsis, just a little bit about the case in your book?
So the setting is what drew me to the case. The crimes took place in a place called Saline Valley, which is one of the most remote regions in the Western United States. You go on a two-lane highway towards Death Valley, and you're out in what could fairly be called the middle of nowhere. And from there, you make a turn onto a 50-mile, very rough dirt road when it's even passable. But if you make it through, you come into this valley that's untouched by time. It's absolutely pristine, beautiful desert wilderness with rippling sand dunes and a silvery saltwater lake. And in the middle of this extraordinary desert valley is a hot springs oasis, natural hot springs that hippies and eccentrics and desert rats have developed over the decades into this really cool hangout, kind of a counterculture hangout. And when you first arrive there, you wouldn't be surprised to see people just walking around naked, except for maybe a hat and a pair of sandals. So Barry and Louise Berman were on a romantic trip. It was a makeup trip, Michael. They had had some difficulties in their marriage. They were kind of a mismatch in a way. She was 52. He was 35. Mm-hmm. She'd had kind of a wild past. Barry was her fourth husband. He was the heir apparent to the Kahlua liqueur fortune. But they found themselves back together on this vacation. They go to the hot springs. They arrive. They soak in one of the pools. The next morning, they get up. They go for a walk, and they never come back.
And I want everybody to know this as well, because I'm fascinated with this case. I worked on it a little bit myself on a TV show called Autobiography Cold Cases. I was not the lead researcher or producer for that episode. That was my friend Alexis Boozer. Obviously, we didn't have years. In fact, we had COVID kind of limiting what we were allowed to do. But there's certain things that stood out to me about this case that have never left my mind. One is where this happened. And you just described Saline Valley. But when you say remote, I think one of the things I was reading about it early on was this is the modern Wild West and untouched, and how hard it is to get to this place. My crew went out, I think, two or three times and could never get there. So this is, like you said, you can't always get there. And there are some, what I'll put quotes around, like locals, but they don't technically live there full time, but there are some people that are kind of there most of the time. And yeah, it's also I think most people don't know everybody's real name. It seems like everybody has a nickname in this area, which also is just something that's completely interesting and strange about this case as well.
So they're not called locals. They're called regulars.
Or
saliners.
Okay, great.
But among the folks who go out there, they call themselves regulars. And yeah, they don't call them nicknames. They call them handles. So lots of people have a handle. I don't think I have a handle, at least not one that's been said to my face. And I don't, yeah. And I don't espouse a handle. I've never embedded myself in the social scene out there, but I've been going there for decades. And in fact, when you're at the hot springs, you look to the west and there's this incredible view of the Inyo Mountains. The east face of the Inyos is a 10,000 foot escarpment, just this sheer mountain range. And there are deep canyons in those mountains. All three of my children were baptized at the base of one of those canyons in a little waterfall trickling off these desert mountains. So that's how attached I am to the area, Michael. And it is just an amazing place. It's kind of like a religion for some of the people that go out there. And when you're there, it's a little bit like being on a ship at sea. The people around you become your friends. You might socialize. People are smoking joints or having a drink, and you know they're getting naked in hot tubs. It's not a hookup spot. Mm-hmm. It's more of a back to nature, but the bounds of conventional society don't apply. And the differences between people seem to melt away. And it's a very peaceful, communal kind of a place. So the notion that two very peaceful, they were vegetarians, Barry and Louise were adherents of a religion called Radha Soame. They were devotees of a Punjabi guru. They believed in transcendental meditation. Mm-hmm. They believed that the slaying of meat gives rise to bad karma. They wouldn't eat meat. For two people in this place to just vanish and then later turn up miles away in a grave was mind-boggling for those of us who love this area.
Yeah, and you talk about it being peaceful, and I think, you know, some listeners that may not understand this, when they hear like nudists and eccentrics and in the middle of the desert, why is it so shocking that people go missing here? But it seems that there are unwritten rules, unwritten laws about how you behave and how respectful you're supposed to be to not just others around you, but also the place itself, correct?
Very much so. There's an unwritten code. And if you come in there and kind of violate that code, you'll be talked to in a nice way. A couple of people might come up and say, hey, you know, we don't really play loud recorded music out here. Or, you know, it's fine to, if a naked woman comes and gets in the tub, of course, it's fine to glance at her and say hello, but we don't go around leering at women, that kind of thing. It's a very respectful, very back to nature kind of environment. And most people get with the program. They feel that energy, they feel that vibe. And there's a real communal sense, a shared sense of belonging and togetherness that cuts across other kinds of boundaries. I mean, you'll have people of all political stripes from various backgrounds. I say in the book, you might find firefighters on a weekend retreat and a magic bus nearby with hippies. That's not just something I made up. I've been there with friends of mine, mountaineering buddies of mine, who are firefighters, and nearby is a bunch of hippies in a magic bus. And, you know, of course, as a guy who went to Berkeley in the 70s, I totally get both. You know, I relate to the mountaineer guys and I relate to the hippies. And there is that very shared sense. A lot of artists are drawn to the location, a lot of free thinker types. It's an amazing spot. The silence is so pervasive that it's palpable.
Oh, interesting.
It's hard to describe. It's almost like being on another planet. And I think it's possible that sense of separateness, that sense of being away from conventional society, could be misinterpreted by somebody with deviant tendencies to think, hey, anything goes.
Right.
And that could lead to trouble.
Right. So let's back up just a little bit here so people understand who the Burmans are. Barry was the heir to the Kahlua fortune. Louise is older than him, which is not the usual thing when you see in male-female relationships. But yeah, what can you tell us about where they lived, you know, how they met? What kind of information do you want to share about them?
Yeah, they came from very different backgrounds, Michael, and that's part of what makes them so fascinating as a couple. Louise grew up in more working class circumstances and had a difficult childhood. She was abused as a little girl, and rather than throwing the abuser out of the house, her mother threw her out of the house and farmed her to live with other people. But her mother was the kind who cycled through a lot of men. Once the abuser was gone, Louise moved back in with her mom, but they never bonded. And I think the abuse very much affected her and affected her outlook. She became sexually active at a young age. She was married while still in high school. And then she had three husbands before Barry. She had three children from two different men. When she came into the 60s, she evolved from being kind of a glamorous, coiffed secretary with manicured nails to being more of a 60s wild child, doing drugs. She slept with a lot of men. She went through some rough times. She even ended up in jail for a while. Barry, on the other hand, was also very deeply influenced by the 60s, but in a different way. Barry was 17 years younger and grew up in a family of almost unfathomable wealth, at least for normal folks. I mean, the Beverly Hills lifestyle that his father led was at a scale that is hard to imagine. First of all, his wife was what you might call well-bred. She'd been a child of a very wealthy New York family, had been sent to Switzerland to boarding school. She was a bit aloof. She didn't believe that women such as her should be hands-on with their kids. She wasn't the kind to give Barry a lot of hugs. His dad was all over the world doing mega deals. Not only did he build the Kahlua brand into this massive, massive success, but he was also involved in bringing exotic, what were considered exotic beverages into the United States, he spotted a trend that people might like brands from overseas. So he was one of the people that spearheaded bringing Heineken to the United States, J&B Scotch, et cetera. And so he had massive success there, but he also got into the oil business, real estate development on a huge scale, Huntington Harbor. If you know Lake Arrowhead in Southern California, he and his partners bought the entire lake. They bought over 3,000 acres of the surrounding woodlands. They bought the entire village. They're the ones who developed the golf course up there. I mean, this guy was rolling big. He had a yacht named Kahlua. He flew private. He had a big lodge on the shores of Lake Arrowhead. He had a big place down in Acapulco. He would hang with other wealthy entrepreneurs like Armand Hammer. This is the scale that he rolled at. The Flying Tiger line, which was a predecessor to FedEx, he and the founder had a 10,000-acre hunting preserve together.
Wow.
That's Barry's dad, and he just didn't have a lot of time for his son. He would kind of throw money at his son, but he didn't give him love and attention. And because Barry grew up in such a frigid environment, he became kind of a loner. He's a very thoughtful, pensive young man. He would go up into the hills behind his house. As he got into high school, maybe he would get stoned, or he even, you know, would drop acid, like a lot of folks in the 60s. He developed a close circle of friends. And when his dad bought the El Capitan Ranch, which was 3,500 acres of oceanfront land north of Santa Barbara, there were some cottages by the oceanside on kind of an isolated parcel of land. And him and his friends would go out there for the weekend and they'd hang out. Maybe they'd do mushrooms and surf, that kind of thing. By the way, the land where they used to hang out is now, or later was sold to Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie. But that's a you know, one of those interesting connections. But anyway, they both, Barry and Louise, both went looking for something that was missing in their lives, Michael. And they both found their way to this Punjabi guru, Charan Singh, very charismatic. He had millions of followers worldwide. And it was at what's called a satsang, which is a bit like Sunday service in a Christian church. At a satsang in Santa Barbara, that's how they met. Louise was looking for a place to live. She moved into one of the oceanfront cottages, actually became Barry's roommate, and the two became intimate. She was probably the first woman in the 35 years that Barry had been alive by the time he passed away. He was 29 when they met, probably 30 when they became intimate. She was probably the first woman he had ever slept with.
So here they are, you know, 5 or so years after they meet. And as you said, they went through a rough patch. This is a bit of a get back together sort of bonding trip out to the hot springs. And I'd love to hear a little bit about the day or the night before they went missing, because I know they got in the hot springs, correct? And then what happened from there?
So it was January. So we're talking short days, longer nights. They left home on this makeup trip. They were driving a four-wheel drive Datsun pickup. Back then, not a lot of people had four-wheel drives. They weren't as much of a thing. So Barry was an experienced traveler into the backcountry, especially by four-wheel drive. He and a close friend of his, a jewelry maker named Arthur Korb, also a disciple of Charan Singh, they would go on these trips to explore remote hot springs. Well, Barry's profession was to craft decorative ironwork. And he wanted, on their makeup trip, to go out to Scotty's Castle in Death Valley because Scotty's Castle, a.k.a. Death Valley Ranch, is an extraordinary mansion that has a lot of beautiful wrought ironwork. So Barry and Louise, after camping out one night, ended up at Scotty's Castle, and he took a lot of photos of the ironwork and everything. Anyway, eventually they end up driving into Saline Valley. Arthur Korb, the jewelry maker, close friend of Barry's, had said, hey, if you're going to be out in that area, you've got to check out the hot springs in Saline Valley. So they arrived after dark, which speaks to Barry's confidence and his abilities in the wilderness, because it's tough to navigate your way. Mm-hmm. And it was a moonless night, by the way. So January 5, 1986, they arrive after dark, and the hot springs There's one main area that's been developed into bathing pools where the water's been piped from the natural springs into these bathing pools. And that place is kind of a social scene. There's a lawn. There's lots of palm trees. There's a little outdoor library. It's a wonderful spot. But for people who want a little more of a back to nature experience, a little less of a social scene, from those springs out in the middle of Saline Valley at this oasis, you go uphill about 3/4 of a mile, and there's a smaller set of springs, less developed, and it's called Palm Spring, mm-hmm. Palm singular. Some people call it Palm Springs, but it has nothing to do with the city, Palm Springs. It's just this little sub-oasis. And that's where they pulled in late in the evening. There's, as I said, there's no moon in the sky. So in the total darkness, they get out. They actually were wearing bathing suits, which is interesting. They weren't prudish, but they were reserved. Mm. I think they probably would have taken off their clothes if they'd been there, you know, longer. But initially, they put on bathing suits, and they slip into one of the tubs. And in that tub were three men who were bathing under the stars and chatting. And that was their introduction to the hot springs at Saline Valley.
And can you share with us who was in the tub with them?
So this is where the story starts to get interesting. Yeah. Because, listen, somebody killed these people. It was clear. We can talk about why that was clear and when and where the bodies were found. But right now, let's focus on the people. And Michael, your question, because it's very pertinent. There weren't a lot of people around up there. Now, down at the main springs, yes, there were more people. There were probably 50 people or so, something like that, at least a few dozen. I know that because a ranger, who's also a mountaineering buddy of mine, happened to drive through.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he happened to drive through right before the Burmans arrived, the day before the Burmans arrived. So he gave me a picture of what he remembered, a mental picture of what he remembered about sort of the scene. The New Year's crowd was starting to disperse, but there were still a number of people. But up at the Palm Spring, there were only a couple of groups. There was a military man who was traveling alone. There were three motorcycle riders from Modesto. And there was a family from Northern California. I believe they were from Humboldt County, a dad and a mom and a 10-year-old boy. And then there was the Burmans. And that was it. Those were the only people in camp. So when they got into the hot tub, the military man who was traveling alone was soaking, as were two of the three motorcycle riders. And that's who they first met.
One of the men, can I use his name? Am I allowed to use his name?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
So there's a guy named Mike. Correct?
Mike the Marine.
And he actually propositions a couple, and I can't remember, is that the Burmans or is that somebody else?
So that happens after the Burmans disappear, and it reveals a lot about what may have been motivation. Let's get down to the quick a little bit. So when the sheriff's department, Inyo County Sheriff's Department, started to investigate the Burmans' disappearance, they were able pretty quickly to identify the motorcycle riders and to interview them. And these guys were just very open, very willing to talk. They had nothing to hide. They weren't trying to coordinate their stories. They had photos of what they'd been doing. They freely admitted that they rode their motorcycles sometimes where they shouldn't have, because it is wilderness, it's mm-hmm. protected. They admitted, oh yeah, we did go off the road, you know, that kind of thing. These are just down-to-earth, kind of rambunctious guys. When I interviewed them years later, they were straight shooters. They sent me their original photos the trip.
Oh, that's great.
Date stamped on the back. You could see where they had gone the day that the Burmans disappeared. The man named Mike, though, was much harder to track down, and his whereabouts on the day and his activities on the day that the Burmans disappeared was highly suggestive. And I'll tell you why. So they get up in the morning on Monday, January 6th, and the woman from Humboldt County in Northern California, she was the hippie couple with their 10-year-old son, she sees the Burmans taking off early with their backpacks going up the road. When I say the road, At Palm Spring, there's a rough Jeep trail. It's really a road made more by years of wheel tracks rather than a bulldozer ever having been run through there. But it's a road of sorts, and it heads up the northeastern side of Saline Valley and eventually crosses over a pass and goes down a very rugged canyon accessible only by four-wheel drive and ends up in a place called Eureka Valley. But people sometimes on a day hike will head up this road. We'll call it a road. There's a couple of things they might want to see along the way. There's a cabin. That's a whole side story there. And then there's some natural undeveloped springs a couple miles up. Now, we know that Louise had a sore ankle and didn't plan to do much hiking. And we also know that they left their cameras behind. And typically, if you're going on a long hike, you'd probably bring your cameras. Right. So that indicated that they were probably just out for a morning walk. So after they leave camp, the motorcycle riders see the military man, and he's taking some of his supplies out of his truck and leaving them in camp. He's kind of prepping for a day trip. He's got some extra gas, some water. He's got a shovel in the back. He's driving this little Datsun pickup truck. Coincidentally, the Burmans were also driving a Datsun. He's driving a little Datsun pickup truck and slowly making his way up this road. Well, fast forward, late in the afternoon, he comes back down the road. By that time, another couple had arrived in camp. An older guy, well-known mountaineer in the Eastern Sierra, but they asked that I not use their names, so I've respected that. And his longtime partner, a very beautiful younger woman. The two of them were well known in the kind of the community of mountaineers out there. They were both really, really committed outdoors people and artists. When the military man, Mike, driving his little pickup, gets back to camp, he comes over and talks to them, and particularly to her. He's dirty. He's covered in dust. He seems edgy. And he said, you know, I quit smoking, but I'd like to, do you have some cigarettes? I'll trade you a can of peaches for a pack of cigarettes. So they were like, sure. You know, they had some cigarettes. So they traded him for a pack of cigarettes. And he starts chatting with this younger, beautiful woman. And it's only a matter of minutes. He starts like hitting on her, floating the idea of a threesome. So whatever had happened, he came back into camp dirty, edgy, and sexually energized. And that was highly suggestive. Yeah. And law enforcement felt perhaps that suggested a motive for why the Burmans are later found right in a shallow grave, miles away, farther than they reasonably could have walked, right? Mm-hmm. So how did they get there? Well, did they ride on the back of these little off-road dirt bikes? I actually examined one of those dirt bikes. It's still around. It's still at the house of one of the motorcycle riders. He has it under a tarp. I took a look at it. There's no way you can get a second person on it. There's no seat. There's no passenger foot pegs. But a Datsun little pickup, you can get three people in the cab. It's close quarters. Right. But you can get three people in the cab.
So they disappear, and again, if memory serves, please correct me if I'm wrong, but they kind of put the pieces together that this couple is missing when the truck, their Datsun, their 1982 Datsun, is just sitting around for a while. And a gentleman discovers the truck, and doesn't he radio the police like, hey, something may have happened to these folks?
So out here at this oasis, it was a little bit of anarchy. Technically, though, this is federal land administered by the Bureau of Land Management. And at a certain point, the Bureau of Land Management felt like we need to have some measure of control out there. Well, there was a guy who was living out there. He was called Chili Bob. Chili Bob lived in a little trailer year round. He loved to drink beer, and he just became a fixture. And he had a two-way radio. And so the Bureau of Land Management thought, well, we will anoint him as the campground host. And then if any problems happen, he can radio in and radio for assistance. So eventually somebody reports to Chili Bob, hey, there's this truck up at the Palm Spring and people aren't around. There was a couple there, but they vanished and haven't come back. And so he radios into the sheriff's office for assistance. Well, when the sheriff's deputy finally comes out, and that takes a while, they finally get out there and they realize, hey, these people are nowhere to be found. And meanwhile, their family and friends are saying, hey, they were due back home days ago. And now all of a sudden, it becomes a big thing, especially when the sheriff's office finds out this unassuming hippie type guy who disappeared is actually the heir to a massive fortune. And his father, who is wealthy and connected, is asking, where the hell is my son? What are you going to go do to find him? Well, that spurs a massive search. There were aerial assets brought in from the California Highway Patrol, from China Lake Naval Weapons Center, from the Stockton National Guard. There were ground teams from adjacent counties. It became like a war zone out there. Dozens and dozens of trained searchers, off-road vehicles, helicopter assets, everybody out there looking. The search goes on for 2 weeks solid and not a trace. And they continue searching. And then Jules Berman, Barry's dad, does a private search and nothing turns up. The Bermans are just gone. And there's all kinds of theories. Were they kidnapped for ransom? Only there's no ransom demand. Some of the people in Saline Valley were like, oops, you know, a UFO must have gotten.
Right, right.
The sheriff's office was like, wait a minute, they're disciples of a Punjabi guru. Is this some kind of a cult thing? But all those false leads get quickly eliminated. And the sheriff's office starts to zero in on, this looks like foul play. You've got two people that are gone. We've scoured the desert. And in this wilderness, although it's very rugged, you can see things from the air. And the searching was done at low altitude, crisscrossing for days. And it just didn't seem reasonable that they were lost in somewhere. They explored canyons and ridges. I mean, it was a very thorough search and not a sign.
How long was it until they discovered the bodies?
Almost 3 years. So they disappear in January 1986. In November 1988, about 7 miles up this rugged road that I was talking about that leads away from the Palm Spring campground into some of the most remote desert wilderness in the western United States. About 7 rugged miles up that road and then off the road, there was a hiker that was coming down from, he was a Desert Peaks kind of guy. And I understand exactly what he was doing because I've done a lot of Desert Peak bagging and getting into some of these remote peaks and adding them to your list is part of the accomplishment. This is what people who are into bagging Desert Peaks do. And there was a route into a couple of peaks that you would go up that, if the this corridor, it was called this rough road, and then you could cross an area, a rugged area of the desert, and then scale some adjacent mountains, a mountain range called the Last Chance Range. And you could get into the Last Chance Range by going that way. Now, not many people do it. I mean, it's a very rugged approach, mm-hmm. but it's very elegant. It allows you access to some really interesting lines. And if you're a mountaineer that really wants a clean, direct, very difficult ascent route in some country that rarely sees any people, this is an area where you might go. So this guy that's coming down from a hike into this remote area, he's a desert peak bagger, he's crossing through this area of desert, and he sees something shiny. And it turns out it's a human skull. So he takes the skull, puts it in his little pack, and brings it down to the lower warm springs, the main hot springs in Saline Valley. At that point, Chili Bob was gone from Saline Valley. A guy named Major Tom was the campground host. Major Tom radioed into the sheriff's office, and it became apparent to everybody, hey, this probably connects to the Berman case. So the next day, when the investigators go back to the scene with the hiker and with Major Tom, they end up finding the rest of the remains in a kind of a trough of a desert dry wash. You know, a desert dry wash is like a dry riverbed. Mm-hmm. It's where intermittent water flow over thousands of years has carved creek beds and riverbanks. And in a place called a cut bank, where you've got a kind of a shallow trough between a bigger bank and a smaller bank, there was this trough in there. The bodies had been stripped of clothing and stacked and then carefully concealed with rocks and dirt. It was obvious that it was a homicide and that they had been deliberately buried.
Wow. So I guess one of my questions for you was, what sort of evidence around these bones pointed to homicide? And I think you just answered that. Was there anything else about the discovery of the bones that really pointed to that, or just the fact that they were obviously concealed?
They had obviously been concealed. The coroner's report was inconclusive, couldn't determine a cause of death. There was something, again, highly suggestive found with the remains, a tiny handcuff key.
Ooh. That is very interesting.
Twist that around a little
bit.
Yeah,
yeah.
Think about what that suggests.
That's really interesting. So again, I don't want to give away too much of your book because it is worthy of a read, but I do want to talk a little bit more about Mike because it's not hidden knowledge. People can do some research and discover some information about him and his tie to this case. But I'd love to know more about your investigation and how you were able to learn more about Mike, who was the military gentleman you talked about that was with them and had the other Datsun pickup truck.
So the sheriff's office eventually zeroed in on the military guy, and it was quite an amazing endeavor. And I'll leave that to the reader to find out how they were able to track him down and interview him. And he was all over the board when they interviewed him. Let's leave that for the book. But what I will say is they were able to identify somebody who was highly suspicious, who gave inconsistent answers about what he did, who certainly had the means to be able to kill the Burmans and possibly had a sexual motivation based on his behavior afterwards. So his name is Michael Pepe. He has never been arrested, never been charged. And so what I do in the book is lay out the evidence that led investigators to believe that he was the perpetrator, and new evidence in the form of jailhouse informants who came forward and talked about what they said were confessions by him that he was bragging about these killings in prison. Because he is in prison later in his life, he committed unimaginably heinous and violent sex crimes against little girls. And again, that was probably something that was simmering in him and didn't just happen to come out when he was in his 50s. And it's my theory that this could provide a possible motive or explanation for what happened with the Burmans. We know for a fact he would go off the rails with little girls and tie them up, rape them, gag them, beat them, leave them bleeding. So we know for a fact he did that. We can look back at the Burman case and say, this is a possible motivation. There was a handcuff key. He had met them the night before in the hot tub. He drove in the same direction that they were walking. They were found farther than they reasonably would have walked on their own. It's highly likely that they got there at least part of the way in motor vehicle. And it starts to come together of a possible motive and an opportunity for Michael Pepe to be the perpetrator. But again, he's never been charged.
Yeah, it was similar to our TV show, if I remember correctly. And I'm hoping, Alexis, a call for Alexis Boozer Sterling. If you're listening to this episode, we should connect because I'm having trouble remembering all the stuff we came up with. But I do know that we talked a lot about Michael Pepe and came to some similar conclusions in our own investigation, which was not near as in-depth as yours. And I do want my listeners to check out your book. It's a really fascinating book. And again, I don't want to give too much away, so I don't want to say anything more about him or the case, but it's a fascinating case that even after all this time, even after reading your book this week, it's one that I've never forgotten about. It's one that stayed with me and I think always will for a variety of reasons. But before we go, I do want to talk to you about your connection and your history. You told me a little bit about it, to the Mojave, to the desert region, and some of the plans you may have for future true crime and seeing if it ties in with the Mojave region. But tell me about, was it your grandmother who was a prospector?
She was. Yeah, my grandmother, after my grandfather died, my grandmother just did something rather amazing. She was living in the San Francisco Bay Area. That's where she was from and where I was born and raised. So when, I don't even know if I'd been born yet, or I was probably 1 or 2 years old. My grandfather died and my grandmother takes a trip down to Mexico. On her way back, she passes through the Mojave Desert and just decides to sell her house in the Bay Area and relocate to a little cabin, a little artistic little cabin in the middle of this lonely desert valley with Joshua trees all around and mountains. And she becomes a prospector. She had a four-wheel drive truck before four-wheel drives were a thing. She was driving in a big four-wheel drive truck. She would sometimes strap a Josselin 44 revolver to her hip. She said she could talk to rattlesnakes. She said, "Oh, I'm not afraid of rattlesnakes, child. I can feel the energy and talk to them and tell them it's okay, relax." And she was a very spiritual person, a very unique person, very colorful, built some outbuildings. Like she had one that looked like an old miner's cabin, complete with a potbelly stove and all these old bottles and relics on shelves. I mean, imagine you're a little boy and you're brought into this environment and turned loose. I mean, that was it. I was hooked for life. And so as soon as I made enough money and was old enough, I was 16 years old, I bought my own four-wheel drive and started going out in the desert to explore. And I guess I'm still doing it.
Yeah, you are.
And eventually I found my way into Saline Valley and into the surrounding mountains. I did a lot of desert mountaineering out there. One of the firefighters I was talking about, became a real close buddy, and he and I would go on these amazing adventures, bagging peaks and exploring, you know, hidden places in the desert. And that became a passion. And when the Burmans disappeared, I mean, it really affected me. Mm-hmm. Listen, there are places in the desert that feel edgy. I mean, and that's true still today. I mean, there's meth labs and there's spots where you may not want to go knock on the door of that particular house, you know, and there may be kind of junkyard dogs barking and that kind of thing. But this valley, Saline Valley, was not like that. It is a peaceful place, untouched by that kind of thing. And the notion that two people had been murdered in that environment and that the killer had never been caught, that just kind of cast a pall over things. And it gnawed at me for years. So eventually, in 2014, I decided I'm going to look back into this case. And one thing led to another. And then the sheriff's department decided, what the heck, they'll cooperate and turn over records. I began tracking people down, interviewing them. Eventually, I got some of Pepe's family members to talk with me. And one thing led to another. And yeah, just the project over 9 years went past articles and built into a book.
And the Mojave itself, you know, you talk about this draw to it. For someone like me that loves strange stories, and
you're known for your love of the strange stories.
But the Mojave itself is this wonderful place. And I say wonderful because of fascinating stories, not always wonderful things, but it has connections to history in really interesting ways. It has connections to Charles Manson. It has connections to Japanese internment camps. It has connections to UFO sightings. It has connections to, you know, the Air Force and military training and a lot of missing people, a lot of, you know, like you said, people making meth, and there's just a wild scene that can happen. But the most of it, 99.9% of it, is just beautiful nature and wonderful places. I'm actually camping in the Mojave in 2 weeks with my son. Red Rock Canyon, which I've never been to, near sort of Edwards Air Force Base-ish area, and I'm really looking forward to it. So in terms of what's next for you, are you looking at more cases in that region? Or are you looking outside of that region, or is just something interesting coming up to you?
I mine the deserts for stories. That's my passion. So I range from Arizona, California, Nevada, wherever the story might lead, mm-hmm. Northern Mexico. The next book I'm working on arose, I'm in Nevada right now. I'm in the process of relocating to Nevada. I do a lot of writing for the Las Vegas Review Journal. But there was a story, and some of your listeners might remember it, just back in 2022, an 18-year-old girl in Fernley, Nevada, was on her way to work. She actually worked at the Tesla Gigafactory. She worked for Panasonic. It's a joint venture of that factory. And if you work for Panasonic and you live in Fernley, which is kind of a rural suburb, it's sort of a part suburb of Reno and part still just a rural community. She parked her car in a Walmart parking lot, intending to catch an early morning shuttle bus that would take her out to the Tesla factory. And she was sitting in her car, and a 41-year-old construction supervisor, an accomplished guy, well-respected at work, he has a $60,000 truck. He's got a girlfriend at home. He stalks through the parking lot, forces his way into her car, drives with her, with another human being, a little girl, drives with her for over an hour out into the middle of the Nevada desert to a place where he has pre-dug a grave. He rapes her. He murders her. He shoots her in the back of the head. He buries her and then comes home to his girlfriend. Hi, honey, I'm home. I mean, who does that? And that's what I'm exploring in the book. And I'm also chronicling the amazing effort by the family of this wonderful girl, Naomi Urion. I want to talk about her life because she was a wonderful spirit, a beautiful girl, and her family and what they did to try to help find her, and then the efforts by law enforcement to quickly crack the case and bring the perpetrator to justice. So it's an amazing story, but I what makes it a book-length story, I've already written some articles on it, but what makes it a book-length story is probing the depths of the darkness of the human spirit that would cause a man in midlife to do something so horrific.
Well, keep up the good work. I think these stories, as hard as they are sometimes, I think they're important to share and important to learn from and research. So I'm really looking forward to more of your work. And thank you for coming on. Is there anything else you want to tell us about? Any information? I'm going to provide some links to where people can buy the book, but if there's anything you want to plug,
I appreciate it. Well, here it is, the Berman Murders, and it's been a labor of love. And Roman and Littlefield's a publisher, a very respected publisher. I was really lucky to be able to work with them and some great editors. Put my heart into it. I'd be honored if your listeners would read it.
I was very excited that you wrote this book and that you came my way. And I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michael. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening to A Study of Strange. Before you leave, hit that subscribe button to stay up to date. We have a couple of big true crime episodes that are connected to back to back. I think that's going to start next week. Leave us a rating and review. Visit our Substack for more content, which you can find through our website, astudyofstrange.com, in the support tab. Send me ideas, comments, anything you like through astudyofstrange@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening. Good night.